Our next speaker this morning will be Tom Quinn. The title of Tom's talk is Climate Variation and Natural Selection in Salmon. Simon and Garfunkel were right. Tom?
Thanks, Pete. I'm not sure for the folks in the audience if you fully appreciate how difficult it is to speak between Bob Nyman and Jim Carr. Bob's work is so sweeping in scope, and Jim's is so deeply philosophical that I feel quite overmatched. I'm going to be neither sweeping nor philosophical, but I hope in a contrast to their kinds of topics and presentations, there'll still be something of interest here. The second thing I want to mention is my co-author, whom I list first, Stephanie Carlson. I had this idea and got this project started 10 years ago, and eventually Stephanie, an outstanding PhD student, came along. And like any struggling football player, I lateraled the ball to her because she could run faster and farther than I could. And so a lot of the sophisticated analyses were done by Stephanie, but she's now a postdoc in California, and I'm left here to give you the presentation. So about 20 years ago, people started talking about global warming, and it was kind of on the fringes, and it's now become so close to the forefront that even our president in his State of the Union address makes mention of it. It's been screamed on all kinds of headlines, gets all kinds of press and consideration. Some people are talking about things with a little bit more level of sophistication, talking about climate more than just warming, and change, indicating more complex kinds of patterns. And in addition, people are saying, well, it's not just about change, but there's variation. There's ups as well as downs, zigs as well as zags, in addition to some of these trends. Then we take things like El Nino, which was sort of not on anybody's vocabulary in 1983 when I first heard about it, and now it's blabbed about by every weatherman to the point where it's become a meaningless term. Scientists like my colleague Nate Mantua coined the term Pacific Decadal or Interdecadal Oscillation, and this has now become a kind of a classic paper. Now, you know, a classic book is something that no one has read but everyone refers to. Well, a classic paper is one that everybody cites but no one really understands, but certainly issues of climate change are very much in the forefront of ecology at a lot of different levels. So lots of people have focused appropriately on the predicted warming trend, and undoubtedly that's very, very important, and on the ecological processes, flowering in plants, arrival timing in birds, soil moisture, and all those kinds of things, and that's completely appropriate. But what about other effects of climate? Because climate is more than just temperature, and what I'd like to introduce here today, as kind of in contrast to most of the presentations, is what about evolutionary processes? So to give you the venue of this particular presentation, there's a series of drainages in the Bristol Bay region of Western Alaska, where University of Washington faculty, students, and staff have been working since the late 1940s on sockeye salmon populations in areas that have not had substantial landscape alterations. There's no logging, there's no agriculture, there's no hydropower, although there is significant commercial fishing. And the species of interest is the sockeye salmon, which goes from that nice silvery bullet that we put in our cans or our barbecues to the spawning sockeye that you see there in dark red. Well, since the 1940s, about 1950 or so, the university has had a field camp on Lake Nurka in the Wood River system, and the tagline here is lake level is not as boring as you might think. Now, most of us go to a lake like Lake Washington, any other lake, and it appears to be in stasis. But the truth is it's continuously, simultaneously draining and filling. Water is coming in, groundwater, precipitation, inflowing tributaries. Water is being lost at the outlet, evaporation, and so forth. And we only take it for granted because we're not looking at it over an appropriate time scale. So records were taken since about 1950 of lake level at Nurka during the spawning season of salmon in the summer. And the average pattern looks something like this. In the spring, there's this increase in lake level, primarily from melting snow, and then the lake level drops down all summer, and it starts to rise in the fall when it starts to rain, and then we go home. Now, that average graph covers a lot of interesting variation. Again, the basic processes, remember, are snowmelt. These are relatively small drainages, so the water comes off as melting snow in the spring. The lake level then drops until it starts to rain. If we plot the data points for all the years, you can see the overall pattern that I described there, but there's between a meter and 1.5 meters of variation on any given date over the period of record. So there's a pattern, but there's also lots and lots of variation. Well, so what, you might say? Well, if we go downstream from Lake Nurka, where we have the oldest records, to Lake Aleknagik, there are a number of streams that support spawning sockeye salmon, including one that I've been endeavoring to make famous called Hanson Creek. And it flows into the lower area of Lake Aleknagik. Well, Hanson Creek is an extremely productive stream. It averages between 1 and as many as 10,000 sockeye per kilometer after the commercial fisheries. But before the sockeye reach these virtually perfect spawning gravels, they have to struggle through a very, very shallow delta where the stream itself in a gravel-rich environment meets the lake. And what you're looking at is our boat, which is beached there, and sockeye salmon, some alive, some flopping over as they struggle by the thousands up the creek. And this is actually a fairly common sort of situation. This is not an unusual picture. Well, I noticed this and got thinking about it. And we watched the fish here, hi-ho, four in a row, making their way up the creek. And I'm thinking, boy, this is actually a rather stressful sort of situation. We don't have the Army Corps of Engineers to channelize it and dig a passage structure to help them out. The fish live, the fish die. This is Alaska, and that's kind of the way things go. And I started thinking about a fish there, and this is, again, fairly typical. The channel at the mouth there is about 4 centimeters deep, so even a fairly modest salmon is exposed, and a large salmon is strongly exposed to the environment. This guy's eye is above water. He's saying, ah, this smells like home, but gosh, this is going to be a tough go, and we wonder how things happen for them. So occasionally they get up onto the gravel. Their tails no longer get traction there. They struggle, and flop over. And some simply die there. They die of desiccation, heat prostration, their eyes are pecked out by gulls. It's a pretty bad end. Others pass through this stressful delta and reach the good spawning gravels upstream. Now, some of those may get killed by bears, and they'll not all breed, but at least those upstream of the delta have a chance to breed. Those that die at the mouth have a reproductive success of absolutely zero. So we posed 4 research questions. First, is the stranding size selective? Does the mortality rate vary with lake level? Does selection intensity vary with lake level? And what climate factors affect it? Now, those of you that have had at least 2 cups of coffee probably know where this whole story is going. But after all, I mean, a significant fraction of Americans don't buy into the whole evolution thing in the first place, so I figure the token evolutionary ecology story has got to be pretty straightforward here in order for people to kind of come along with me. So the first thing we started doing in the early days was measuring the body size of the fish that stranded and those that made it up there. And what we have here in green is the size distribution of males, and in red, the proportion of fish of each of those size bins that died at the mouth, that failed to make it past there. And you can see that the mortality is strongly size selective. We don't have very many big fish, but those big fish have a real tough go of it. So that was the general assessment. Significant numbers of fish are dying, and the mortality seems to be size selective. Well, we kept going, and Stephanie came along and did some relatively fancy analyses. What we have in the top for males in blue and the bottom for females in red or pink is a measure of fitness of fish of different sizes. The important thing to take away from it is the smaller fish have higher fitness, that is, they are more likely to make it through the delta, because we assign fitness of 1 to the fish that make it and 0 to those that don't. The second thing is it is consistently downward for both males and females by size, but it also varies from year to year. And it varies because the lake level varies. So this is a picture of Kirsten Holzman in 1999, a student in my class, and she's weeping the demise of these sockeye. There's the teaching assistant, Greg Buck, in 2000 in the same location, and you can see that the fish could easily sail right up there without much in the way of a problem. So the first question is, what is the relationship between the proportion of fish stranding and lake level? And lake level here, because the gradient is relatively straight, is a surrogate for the distance in the delta that the fish have to struggle before they make it from the safety of the lake to the breeding grounds of the creek. And you can see that in years when the lake level is high, you get a substantially lower fraction of the fish that are stranding. And in some years, you're getting 30, almost 40% of the fish don't even make it into the breeding grounds of the creek. So in extreme events, it's a really, really severe source of pre-spawning mortality. And it is strong on both males and females, although stronger on males because they tend to be larger and are also more deep-bodied. They're shaped differently. They're a higher center of gravity. That wasn't too surprising. But what was really interesting was not just is the mortality more severe in years when the lake level is low, but it is also more selective. And what we have here is the selection differential, and zero would be no size selection whatsoever. One would be completely size selective. And the point is that even in the years when the lake is relatively high, the larger fish have a tougher time making it. And the lower the lake level, not only do we have a smaller fraction of fish making it, but the mortality is even more and more and more size selective, magnifying the evolutionary effect of that particular process. And I point out that it is not necessarily so, but the data strongly indicate that over the 10 years that we've been doing this over a pretty good range of conditions. So now at this point, people are probably expecting this monotonic decrease in lake level, you know, global warming, and all that sort of thing. Well, this represents the lake level during the period of migration. And so we took the period when 80% of the fish migrate into the creek based on our detailed records, behind cast using the Lake Nurka records over the long period, and you can see lots of ups and downs. And maybe if you sort of put your hand out there at about 1980 and only looked on the right side, you might see the lake level tending to go downward. But overall, there is no absolute trend. There's just quite a lot of variation back and forth. And the years that we've seen lately are not the highest nor the lowest over the period of record. So the obvious question is, what are the factors? And I'm not a climatologist, neither is Stephanie. We really just did some kind of quick and dirty analyses. Undoubtedly, a hydrologist or a climatologist could do a more sophisticated job, but we came up with two predictors that work pretty well. The first is May air temperatures. And again, you're coming out of the winter. There's going to be some bed of snow on that area. If it's relatively warm in May, what happens is the snow melts off quickly because the streams are relatively short. The water all flushes into the lake, and then there's no more snow by the time July comes around, and so the lake level just drops like a stone. The second process is rain, because sometimes it rains really hard because the streams are relatively short. It rains hard, boom, the lake will bounce right up after a couple of days. So the combination of rain during the breeding period or immediately prior to it and warm conditions earlier affecting the main input from melting snow seem to control a lot of the variation there. And of course, both of these are subject to some level of climate effect. The temperatures in general have been getting warmer, but there's also been some quite rainy summer periods, so you've got a kind of a mix of effects there. Pete is starting to flash at me, so I'll get to my conclusions. The first, pretty straightforward, is that access is affected by lake level. Now, this is an extreme case in this particular lake system, but in fact, there are other streams that are also affected by these processes to a lesser extent. The stranding is highly, highly size selective and precludes any chance of reproduction, so fitness of zero for those individuals, so a very strong evolutionary effect. Lake level controls both the proportion and the degree of size selectivity, magnifying the effect of that selection. And there are a couple of fairly quick and simple weather patterns that seem to correlate with it. In the case of Hanson Creek, which also is very, very shallow and has very severe and also size-selective bear predation, we have a synergy between the climatologically driven stranding mortality and predation from bears to combine to have relatively young, small, and Slim Jim-shaped sockeye salmon to avoid those two sources of mortality. In fact, we've shown reduced fitness even by the breeding individuals that are large because they're too vulnerable to those other causes of mortality. So Simon Garfunkel were indeed right, and the song here is from The Only Living Boy in New York, kind of an in-joke because I am, in fact, from New York, and I get the news I need on the weather report. You know, we tend to think of weather as sort of a cliche. It comes at the end of the news just before the slam dunk contest in the sports, but in many ways, it's a very, very profound piece of the news and maybe the most important piece of the news. Whether your consideration is water management for drought, running your ski hills, your crops, all of these kinds of processes for human activities, as well as basic ecological processes, and I think I'd like you to see also evolutionary processes are driven very strongly by these things, and I would encourage people to take that kind of perspective, look for some of those evolutionary processes nested within your ecological work, and you might find something fun. Thanks a lot. Time for our question. Yes, please.
I was wondering if you did any comparative studies between the size of fish without that delta.
The question was whether we've done comparative studies to other streams, and the answer is yes, very extensively. I decided to spare you those data. Immediately next door is Happy Creek, which the fish can swim into quite easily, hence the name Happy Creek. And the fish there are older on average, they are longer for their age, and they are deeper bodied for their length. So they're deeper in all of those, larger in all of those dimensions, even though they're spawning absolutely simultaneously less than a kilometer away. And in general, that seems to be effect of both the stranding mortality, but also size selective predation, because Happy Creek is deeper, habitat is more complex, bears can kill fewer of them, and the predation is less size selective because the bears take what they can get. And that's the general pattern that we see as we go to the different streams at scale. Yes?
So you mentioned that the lake, you mentioned the lake levels, that like 80% of the salmon were returning. I'm wondering, has the timing changed for that?
The question was whether the timing has been altered and whether the processes that I described might play a role in it. The answer is we don't have sufficiently accurate records going back far enough to know whether there is a change. Certainly, the lake is generally dropping at the time when the salmon are entering, and so there is a timing-related mortality as well. Those that enter early tend to encounter higher lake levels and easier passage than those that enter later. And our results clearly show that pattern, that the timing is associated with the mortality. So it probably exerts some effect, and there's a very strong genetic control over breeding date, so I would strongly expect it, but I couldn't demonstrate it. Yes, please.
Did you see any impact to recruitment from this effect?
Well, what's interesting is the gravel in this stream is just perfect. Absolutely perfect. It's like a natural spawning channel. So the fish that go up there enjoy exceptional reproductive success. In this past year, after the commercial fishery took 75 to 80% of the run, there were 20,000 sockeye in 2 kilometers of this creek, and it's only 12 feet across. So it's just exceptional quality habitat. There seems to be a lot of density-dependent processes, so even a fairly modest number of spawners can have quite high recruitment success. Despite these apparently horrific rates of mortality of the fish trying to get up the creek. One more.
Is the commercial fishery another source of size selection?
The question is whether the commercial fishery is a source of size selective mortality. The answer, excellent question, is yes. A grad student of mine, Neela Kendall, has been quantifying that. The magnitude of the size selective fishery, of course, varies among populations because the fishery is operating farther downstream on populations that are both large-bodied and small-bodied. So the Hanson Creek population is probably underfished relative to some of the other populations in the complex that are themselves larger-bodied. The Hanson Creek fish are small and slim, will not be hit as hard in the fishery as some of the larger, deeper-bodied populations, but that's part of what we're exploring, too. Thank you.